This is Jason Stewart with the Vietnam Archive at Texas Tech University, conducting an oral history interview with Dr. Joe Hurt. Today is August the 26th, 2008. I am in Lubbock, Texas, and Dr. Hurt is joining me in Silva, North Carolina. How are you doing today, sir?
Fine.
All right. Why don't we begin by, if you could tell me a little bit of biographical information, when and where you were born, what were your parents' names, that kind of thing?
I was born in Somerset, Kentucky, in 1938. And when I was four, we moved to Black Oak Ridge, Tennessee. And then when I was in the eighth grade, we moved from Tennessee to Raleigh. Mm-hmm. And I finished high school in Raleigh and went to the University of North Carolina for undergraduate school, medical school, and also a PhD program.
Okay.
I was a fellow in National Institute of Health Neuroscience Division during my last 3 years. Three years in Chapel Hill.
Mm-hmm.
After that, as a member of the Berry Plan, which is actually a modified lottery, the service,
okay,
the medical services tried to project how many physicians of each type they would need in a certain year.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone who went to medical school, almost everyone who went to medical school went on deferred draft status and were draftable right after they got out of medical school.
Okay.
With people in the Berry Plan, it was sort of a lottery. You put your specialty in, and then they matched the numbers of physicians in that specialty against their needs. And if you were picked by the Berry Plan, then you finished your postgraduate specialty training and then went immediately into the service.
Okay.
In the specified branch that they picked you for. And the Berry Plan actually allotted the needs for both the Air Force, for the Air Force, Army, and Navy.
Okay.
So, knew sometime during your internship year which branch of the service you knew whether you were picked into the Berry Plan.
Right.
Which branch of the service you would be into, and or whether you were not picked in the Berry Plan and then were immediately draftable.
Mm-hmm.
And most people didn't get drafted immediately, but we got drafted within the next 2 years. I was fortunate and allowed to finish my training and went into military as a board eligible pathologist and neuropathologist.
Okay.
And was assigned to one hardship year in Vietnam, and then to another military post for the second year in the state.
Okay. All right. Before we talk about your entry into the military and your training, you know, I'd like to go back a little bit, if you don't mind. Could you tell me what made you decide to go into medicine?
Well, and that's an interesting stuff. I really had thought I would be a veterinarian, and because I grew up in a very rural environment till I was in high school, but one of my high school English teachers convinced me that what I really should do is go to medical school. And so I made the transition from mentally thinking about veterinarian school to thinking about going into the military, I mean into medicine.
Mm-hmm.
Now, my next phase once I got into medicine was I had decided what I really wanted to do was more on a research and investigative side, and I wanted to, my desire was to go into space and aviation medicine.
Okay.
But because I am partially colorblind, I was not able to pass the flight physical.
Okay.
And you had to be a certified military pilot in order to go into space and aviation medicine.
Okay.
And so then, during my undergraduate year, I was at UNC. After I was accepted into medical school, I was given the option of finishing a four-year undergraduate degree and doing research in pathology, or just going straight to medical school. And I decided to take the undergraduate advanced research fellowship and then went into medical school the next year.
Okay. All right. And did you do your med school at UNC as well?
I did my med school at University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
Okay.
And also I did my internship and my residency, and I got my NIH fellowship transferred from Bethesda to Chapel Hill, and I finished it in Chapel Hill also.
Okay. All right. When did you finish? Before you entered the military, when did you finish with your medical degree?
I finished medical school in 1965. And went into the service in on July the 3rd of 1970.
Okay. All right. Now, but when you finished med school, or when you were in med school, actually, by the time you finished, how aware of you about what was going on in Southeast Asia and in Vietnam?
Oh, I was fairly aware because we had had people in the program who had not matched with the Berry Plan, who had gone on, and some of them had been in Southeast Asia,
mm-hmm.
and were coming back and were now beginning to finish their training as I was leaving. So, plus, you know, the news accounts kept up with it also.
Okay, and what was your thoughts on it at that time? Did you have a particular opinion?
I beg your pardon?
What was your thoughts on it at that time? Did you have a particular opinion at that time about the war?
Oh, no, I thought basically that it was the right thing to do.
Right.
I have no problem whatsoever with that.
Sure.
My university. At the time, though, they were more or less, a lot of the university was
anti-war, they were
anti-Asian, but involvement. But
okay. All right. So did...
I kind of agreed with the philosophy of it, and also I did after I came back.
Sure. Okay. Well, so you mentioned anti-involvement on the campus. So did you see much protest activity? Or?
Yeah, there was quite a bit on my campus, and but it wasn't nearly as radical as it was in a number of other places.
Sure.
But at that point in time, I was do it, completing my residency, and there really was not that much concern. I had very little concern about what was going on the other side of the campus.
Mm-hmm.
Interestingly enough, for me in the medical school, at first there was more concern about the Cuban Missile Crisis in 62 or 63 or whenever it occurred.
Yes, sir.
Because I was in school then and still in medical school then, and that ended up with a lot of local interest.
Sure.
Only all of it was basically positive.
So then you were very, you'd say you were fairly well-versed in what was going on in the world at the time with the stand against communism then.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. And
all of us, I can say for the people that were in at my university and in the Berry plant, we knew that the largest number of us would be assigned to Southeast Asia.
Okay.
Now, uniquely, while I was at Fort Sam, and we're talking 1970, anybody who could speak fluent Hebrew or fluent Arabic was removed from their Vietnam orders and reassigned. So while the fighting war was going on, they were still looking for physicians to fit into any potential situations that might arise in the Middle East. And as you know, there's always something going on over there.
Sure. Yes, sir.
Hadn't changed any since I was in school.
Right, right.
And we're talking 40 years.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. All right. So when you were made the decision to go to medical school, did you know that the Berry plan was probably something that you would end up being a part of and that you would go to?
No. When I started medical school right out of college, you know, I did not even know all of the various medical specialties that existed.
Mm-hmm.
And it was somewhere, I think, during my freshman and sophomore year that I became aware of the fact that the Berry plan would become an option.
Okay. All right. What made you decide to focus primarily on pathology?
Well, I got introduced to it before I got introduced to any other parts of medicine since I took the advanced undergraduate degree program and put off my going into school for a year. And so by the time I'd done that, I was very, very familiar with all of the people in that department rather than and had a graduate working relationship with them rather than just being a medical student in a class. And it was interesting, and it was really of interest to me, and like I said, it is a scientific and research, even on a day-to-day basis in a private hospital setting situation, and
right.
So it just fit my personal needs of or thoughts about how I wanted to practice and how I wanted to live my life without any trouble.
Okay. All right. So When did you find out that you had been selected by the Berry Plan?
That I'd been selected in the Berry Plan?
Yes, sir.
I can't remember whether it was during my senior year of medical school or my internship year. And those papers, I still have those papers, but I really think it was during, I really believe that it was during my internship year, after, within the first 6 months after graduating from medical school.
Okay. All right. And go ahead.
Because I think when I got my acceptance, when you applied, you didn't know which branch of the service you were going in. But, and part of the application was you had to go down to the police department and get fingerprinted.
Okay.
And so, and that indeed was during my, I do remember that that was during my internship year.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So did you go directly from your internship to the military, or was there a time in between?
I was placed in the inactive U.S. Army Reserves.
Okay.
And left in the inactive reserves as long as I was working on my training program.
Okay.
And it was so stipulated so that if I said at the end of my, say, my second year of residency, mm-hmm. that I didn't like this, I want to do something else, I was immediately draftable at that time.
Oh, okay.
The understanding was with the Berry Plan, if you were deferred into a slot, you stayed in that slot and got that training because the military had already projected you as part of their needs.
Right.
5 years down the road.
Okay. All right. Well, let's move on now, I guess, and talk about your entry into the military. And tell me a little bit about what did your family think about you basically being inducted into the military?
What did my family think about my being in it?
Yes, sir.
Well, all of my all four of my uncles and one of my aunts had served in World War II.
Okay.
Two of them served in the Korean War.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was no, it was just accepted as that's something people did.
Sure, sure.
I mean, it wasn't, you know, it was just answering service needs. And my family also was, like most Southern families, in the First World War and in the Spanish-American War and in the Civil War on both sides.
Yes, sir.
And right on down the line.
Right. Okay. I guess one of the things I was trying to get at with that question was did your family have any concern for you? I mean, I know you're not going in as a combat officer, but was there concern or worry for you?
Not really. They expected that I'd be careful. They also knew that the chance of anything happening to me was much greater in an accident than it was actually in a combat situation.
Sure.
So there were, other than that I was going to be gone and in a strange place for a year, nobody seemed to think much about it.
Sure. Okay. Were you married at this time?
I got married during my residency.
Okay.
And actually I was married when I went overseas. Now, that was some concern, and actually I had a 3-year-old son and two days after I received, landed in at Long Bend.
Mm-hmm.
I also was my wife had twins.
Wow.
And if you read the Army regulations, I should not have been shipped over within 30 days of gestation period, but I was, and I was already there for, I knew enough of the medical regulations to know that I shouldn't have been.
Right. Yes, sir. Well, obviously that must have been difficult for you to leave at a time like that.
It was. And the strain was extreme on my first wife, and she actually had a nervous breakdown while I was overseas.
Goodness.
And that, of course, impacted the rest of everybody's life.
Sure. Sure. Okay. Let's see. Back up a little bit, I guess. Can you tell me, once you were inducted into the military,
I'm going, in hopes that this may be my telephone, I'm going to go to another phone to see if I can get a little better volume out of it. It won't bother anything.
Okay.
Let's see if this works better.
Okay.
Nope, it's exactly the same.
Oh, goodness, I'm sorry. Let's see.
Go ahead.
Okay. All right. Once you were in the military and you went to, where did you go for training again? I think you said Sam Houston.
Sam Houston.
Okay. Can you tell me about your training? Tell me a little bit about it, if you don't mind.
Well, basically, it was 28 days. Initially, it was 28 days, and there was some marching, there was some indoctrination into into the military and the purpose. And interestingly enough, in 1965, there were a couple of military physicians, two of them, and one of them is at Fort Bragg, who really became violent war protesters.
Okay.
And the whole plan for this first month in the military is sort of as a training and a historical indoctrination thing came about as part of the recommendations to the medical corps after they were trying to sort out what happened. And this was a dermatologist and somebody else. This was not the Fort Bragg appeared to be a lightning rod for physicians who had problems, but these were only people who were actually protesting the war.
Okay.
And and marching and learning how to handle a weapon and understanding a little bit about military and military expectations.
Right.
Were the reason there for being there. And then since I was on a pathologist on Vietnam orders, then they also sent us to tropical medicine school.
Okay.
Just for a reminder course and for identification of tropical diseases that would be unique to the area that we were in.
Right. Okay. All right. You vaguely mentioned weapons training. What type of weapons were you trained on?
What kind of what?
What type of weapons were you training?
Just very rudimentary with an M16 and also a 45.
Okay.
And because there was a tendency for people to shoot at the medical corps, and being in fire bases, it was decided that that military physicians would be armed in this environment. That it, but it would all be for defense, for defensive and perimeter use only. No.
Sure.
No aggressive or outgoing combat activity.
Right. Okay. All right. You mentioned tropical diseases and such. Could you tell me a little bit about what?
Well, I mean, there was a pretty extensive review course for the various types of malaria, the various types of intestinal and skin parasites, and fungal diseases that were unique to there. I mean, nobody in my medical school or in my whole training program had just seen unknown slides or things like that of the malarias, and that was just in passing. And malaria was a real concern in parts of Vietnam, and they just wanted to make sure that we were adequately prepared to deal with it and recognize it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Did you find this training to be fairly sufficient for what you would be doing?
Yeah, I thought it was, it turned out to be sufficient for our needs there. And actually, it turned out to be helpful back in the States, because every now and then throughout my practice, we'd run into people who had malaria. Most of them were, well, to be perfectly honest, everyone that I saw that had malaria after I entered back into civilian practice, the diagnosis were made in the laboratory, were from foreign nationals who were traveling into our area. As a matter of fact, one of the ones that came in saying that his malaria was back, and the emergency room doctors wouldn't even believe him. But they did order a blood smear, and there was plenty of malaria in it, and he was correct.
Right.
Why his malaria came back while he was on the airplane flying from Germany, I don't know. This was a guy from Nigeria who had flown from Nigeria to Germany, and then later was sent by his company. He worked for Camp Grounds of America, and he was sent by Camp Grounds of America, which is a German company.
Okay.
KOA is a German company. And to the United States, and he was sent to the Cherokee Indian Reservation here to see how they ran their camp. They ran their KOA campground. And so he ends up with a case of malaria in the United States.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And it was more than the background training was more than adequate for the needs of the military while I was there. And actually, a lot of it was helpful because my unit adopted a Catholic orphanage and became their pediatricians and sort of others. And sort of a big brother environment while we were there, and so the topical training helped with the parasitic disease that the kids have.
Okay. All right. What was the background of the doctors who are training you here? Had any of them served in Vietnam? Or?
I beg your pardon? Just a little louder.
I'm sorry. What was the background of the doctors who were training you in this? Were they had they served in Southeast Asia?
Who that were training us?
Yes, sir.
Interestingly enough, most of the people we had were DIs or Sergeant Corman, who had a lot of experience in a lot of the other areas.
Okay.
And then there were physicians that had been there, and one of the things, even for let me see how to phrase this. Even the surgical residents and who had finished their training programs, very few of them had much experience with gunshot wounds.
Mm-hmm.
And this was one of the things that the military had found from the gunshot wounds that civilian physicians were familiar with in the 60s were hunting rifle and pistol things, not the high velocity, high impact military assault weapon type. And so everybody, including the pathologist and even the psychiatrist who didn't like this, learned how to adequately excise and identify the extent of injuries in a injury.
All right.
You still there?
Yes, sir. Yes,
okay.
Sir. Sorry. Okay. Well, is there anything else you'd like to say about your training before we move on to your arrival in Vietnam?
No, it was moderately low key.
Mm-hmm.
And basically what that 6 weeks was for was to prepare us, one, to be able to better recognize illnesses that we had not seen or rarely saw in civilian life, and some information on how to take care of yourself.
Okay.
In a minimally adequate training level, just so in case something did go totally wrong, you might have a better idea of how to make things work.
Sure. Okay. All right. So I guess now we move on to Vietnam. Did you go directly from this advanced training to Vietnam?
No, we were allowed to go home. Actually, we were given travel days from Fort Sam to Travis Air Force Base.
Okay.
And most of us just flew home, spent a couple of days at home, and then flew on out to Travis.
Mm-hmm.
And then went overseas.
All right. And so you traveled over there. I would assume like most people in the Army traveling to Vietnam in a commercial airliner.
Yeah, Trans World, I think.
Okay.
They had four planes, and I think SeaWorld Airlines. SeaWorld Airlines is what it was. And they had four airplanes, and they basically just were a chartered service to the military at that time, if I remember correctly.
Okay.
And my first real run-in with the military was in a more, how would you say, adult way was there was a major, there was a full colonel on our flight, and I was a major.
Okay.
And as you can imagine, there was a tremendous amount of background differences between a career military colonel and a physician who was an obligated volunteer in the service for 2 years.
Sure.
And actually, the first time this thing, which kept raising its head during the 2 years, was on the flight over, because we had left Alaska and were on our way to Yokita, Japan, and we were about halfway there.
Mm-hmm.
And I got asked by one of the there were some corpsmen on the plane to come see a young draftee, and he actually had ended up with a staph cellulitis around his eye.
Mm. Okay.
And which essentially was a medical emergency. And we were going on to Yokita, and I told them they got to make arrangements to take this guy off the plane.
Right.
And because he didn't need all the extra time, because this thing was spreading across his face as we went. And the colonel kept saying, well, you know, we're just going to carry him on. We'll take care of him after we get to Vietnam. And I realized two things. One, I didn't know a whole lot about military side, and also two, that as far as the medical side was concerned, they didn't know anything either. And in medical decisions, with a little prompting from the corpsman, who told me, sir, you can really do this, this is a medical decision, and so your opinion outweighs his. And he didn't like it, and I believe the corpsman, and actually it, for my sake, it was right.
Right, sure.
And we took him off the plane.
Mm-hmm.
And just sort of tolerated the colonel and all his hell raising.
Right. Okay. All right. What was the general feeling on the plane in general about traveling? You know, you're going to Vietnam, and some of the guys on the plane are obviously...
I think by then everybody was more or less aware of it, had settled back in. You were on the plane, you know, and basically I thought the outlook was fairly good.
Mm-hmm.
to good. I mean, there and morale seemed to be fine.
Okay.
And no hassles, no theatrics of any kind.
Okay. All right.
And I think most of the people who were there, not all, but most of the people who were there actually believed in what they were doing and thought it was a necessary thing to do.
Okay.
And I came home believing that it was really very necessary to have done and was really miffed because it had been so politically mismanaged.
Right. Okay.
From the civilian side back in the States.
Okay. Do you remember about the date about when you did when you arrived in country?
We arrived at Benoit Air Force Base.
Okay.
And we're transported about 25, 27 clicks, oh, that'd be what, maybe 15 to 18 miles to Long Bend, which was where the 9th Med Lab was. And then I processed in through the 222nd Personnel Division or Unit or whatever they were. It spent one night there, and then the next morning went to my unit.
Okay.
Now for the others, the combat replacements that came in, they went to a mock-up village for about a 5 or 6 day orientation on some of the hazards and what typical villages look like, what typical booby traps look like, what kind of stupid situations you could get yourself into if you weren't thinking. And then they were then assigned to whatever unit they were.
Okay.
But that part of it was not something that I had to do.
Okay. Did you have any type of in-country orientation upon arrival?
I beg your pardon?
Did you have any type of in-country orientation upon arrival?
No.
Okay. All right. You mentioned that you arrived in Benoit and traveled into Long Bend. How did you get there from Benoit to Long Bend?
We went in a convoy of buses.
Okay. All right.
Probably for some of the guys, it's the last bus they rode till they got home.
Right. Mm-hmm. Okay. And as you're traveling from Benoit to Long Bend to the 9th Medical Lab and to your assignment, what were your first impressions upon arrival?
It was really flat. It was really hot. And although there was a military base, once you got outside of the military base, it just looked like pretty flat country.
Okay.
Because there was really no evidence of the war being around in the immediate vicinity of anywhere that I was the first day in.
Okay. All right. Could you describe Long Bend for me, the base? Could you tell me a little bit about it?
Long Bend was the largest military base in Vietnam, it had its own military command up on a hill with a whole bunch of generals in it, which I only saw once. Mainly was supports, facilities, warehouses, and plywood buildings.
Okay.
Some major parts of the road through the camp were paved. Most of it was gravel or mud.
Mm-hmm. Okay. How about the ninth medical lab's facilities? Could you tell me a little bit
the
about
the ninth medical lab facility? Was actually a real jewel for that part of the world. To give you an idea, it was a cluster of Butler buildings, you know, the metal Butler-type buildings that have this corrugated steel sides, steel roof. And they were insulated, and as well, and because of the equipment that we were using, and they had to be temperature controlled, were air conditioned.
Okay.
None of the the enlisted men quarters, which were adjacent to it, were Quonset huts with plywood floors and open ends, and we shared our site with, of all things, a military police unit.
Okay.
And they neither their quarters nor facilities were as good as ours.
Mm-hmm. How about your own quarters? Could you describe those to me?
How about what?
How about your own quarters? Could you describe your own quarters to me?
I'm sorry, you're going to have to speak just a little louder.
How about your own quarters? Could you describe those to
me? My own quarters were in a two-story plywood building, which I had been told this type of building had been field tested and would burn to the ground in 20 minutes.
Wow.
And that fire was a real hazard and to be careful of it. But I had a 10 by 12 room.
Mm-hmm.
It had a cot in it. It had a little refrigerator and a desk and a light.
Okay. Which, compared to the average enlisted man, that's pretty good. Hello? Hello?
I'm trying to hang up that phone.
Oh, we've got some interference here. Hello?
We'll be fine. And my quarters had a concrete floor. We had a shower. Common, about 8 to 10 man shower, and of course there was an air raid and bomb and mortar shelter on the outside that we went to, and I was on the first floor, and fortunately, and the first floor had sandbag bunkers around it, but they didn't reach up high enough for the second floor.
Okay. That brings up a question I wanted to ask you. Did Long Bend ever come under attack by the enemy when you were there?
Yeah, several times. A lot of it was just sappers.
Mm-hmm.
And there, while I was there, there were a couple of rocket attacks. One pit, they ran the fence. And actually, one of the people, the MP unit, had they set it up, and they had hired a civilian barber. And that's the other thing. For every GI that was on that post, there was the ratio was about 10 to 1 Americans to Vietnamese civilians who had been hired to do things on the post. And one of the barber for the MP battalion, the native barber, was found dead in the fence.
Wow.
Turns out he had been a plant that had been hired, and actually was a member of the Viet Cong.
Right. Wow.
And everybody talked about, well, you know, he joked with everybody and was seemingly fine, and nobody got their throat cut or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
But it was sort of a sobering reminder that things are not exactly what you thought they would be.
Sure.
And the outcome for those people who had worked for the military it was all over with, they were very suspect, and my understanding is that an awful lot of them lost their lives or lived very, very poorly as a result of them having been associated with the Americans.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
While the Americans were there.
Okay.
And actually, if you remember the... I did not know this until I saw her again at one of the med lab reunions. They had still do have reunions about every other year,
okay,
but there's fewer people. When the embassy fell and the helicopters were going off the top, and there was a woman hanging on to the strut.
Right.
Well, she had been secretary for and clerk typist for our unit, and ultimately she married the guy who was XO for the unit while I was there.
Okay.
And she got out hanging off of that helicopter strut.
Wow.
And I saw her in Texas, and there were about four of the clerical people there, and they had gotten out and actually were living in Seattle.
Okay.
And they told me that Kim Benn was the person on the straddling the helicopter.
Right. That brings up one question that I wanted to ask you. What was your initial impression of the Vietnamese as you came into contact with them at the base? What did you think of them?
I'm sorry, could you say that a little louder?
I'm sorry. Sorry, I'm still having a little trouble here,
yeah.
I guess. That brings up a question I wanted to ask you, which was, what was your initial impression of the Vietnamese when you first came in contact with the Vietnamese?
Of the Vietnamese?
Yes, sir.
Basically, they were a real simple and a real friendly people, the ones that I knew, and the ones that we ran into in the village streets, and people that took care of the orphanage.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the first time we went out to the orphanage, the village chief came by and wanted us to come every Friday or every Saturday. And I told him that, you know, we'd try to come when we could, but I wasn't telling anybody when we were coming.
Right.
And when we came, we were basically taking care of the orphanage. We'd take care of anybody from the village who could make it there. But we were not, because the orphanage was not in what was considered a secure area.
Okay.
And so we were not going to set up a timed routine that everybody could count on.
Sure. Yeah, that's completely understandable. You could easily set yourselves up for an ambush or something.
Oh, yeah.
Right. Okay. Could you, before, I was going to ask you about, move on to the medical lab, but since we're talking about the orphanage, could you tell me a little bit about it and how the 9th Medical Lab came involved with it and how you came involved with the orphanage?
Well, in my living quarters,
mm-hmm.
I actually had 4 chaplains that lived close around.
Okay.
And after about 2 months, they came and asked me if there was any way that we could be of some medical assistance to an orphanage at GOFAT. And I said, well, we'll go back and talk about it. My commanding officer was a colonel. And he was the CO. I was the officer in charge of the pathology units that were there, and we talked it over, and my CO had been a family practitioner before he went into the military and retrained as a pathologist. So we said, yeah, that it'd be a good, it would probably be a good thing, and it'd get the enlisted men off of the base and allow them to do something that they would probably feel pretty proud of, and if they wanted to. And we had had a small number of really combat trained people also assigned to the unit, and so we decided we'd do it.
Okay.
And it was really a good thing. I mean, it was something that we'd go out and spend maybe 4 hours at the orphanage going through what was just basically sick call, taking care of cuts, colds, wounds. And as soon as we got back, then the people in the unit would start planning on getting stuff together and where they could scrounge up things that they could take out for the next time that we were going. And they continued to support this orphanage even after I left until the unit itself was broken up and brought home.
Okay. All right. Are there any specific memories that stick out in your mind about working with the orphanage? Anything in particular
about what?
Any specific memories that stick out in your mind about working with the orphanage? Any of the children you remember specifically?
Oh, not an individual child. It's just that they were just sweet kids and a little older than my oldest child at home. And they all had specific needs, and boy, they just they could tear at your heartstrings in a minute.
Mm-hmm.
And the orphanage was run by an order of Catholic nuns.
Okay.
But I don't know any more about that other than that they were Catholic and that they were nuns.
Right. Okay. All right. And a lot of these children, were they children whose parents had been killed in the war or abandoned, or do you know?
A combination of children who had been killed in the war, children who were of mixed parentage, who had been, who were fathered by some of them, the French, before they left,
right.
and some by Americans also, in addition to children who no longer had parents could not take care of them, and so they had brought them to the orphanage.
Right. Okay. All right. Let's see. Well, is there anything else you'd like to say about your work with the orphanage before we move on to the Ninth Medical Lab?
Lab?
Is there anything else you want to say about your work with the orphanage before we move on?
The only thing is that the other thing was that the sisters always would get ice.
Mm-hmm.
And Kool-Aid for the kids and for us. And that was a big treat for the kids. And for us, we just, because the ice in the water really just was not safe.
Sure.
We could never get them to understand why we wouldn't drink it.
Right.
And I will say the guys that did get sick.
Right.
But other than I really wonder what happened to some of those kids, and especially to the sisters after this whole thing was over, because I'm sure that the fact that they were Christians of any sect,
sure,
did not sit well with the North Vietnamese after this whole thing was over.
Right. Sure.
And yeah, I guess we can close that out right now.
Okay. All right. excuse me. Okay, talking about the Ninth Medical Lab, and could you tell me about the Ninth Medical Lab's larger role within...
Our large role was that we supplied the in-country tissue diagnosis for diseases and surgical things that were removed. We monitored, shipped, and verify all the blood supplies that they came from the Red Cross.
Mm-hmm.
And the States to Vietnam. We also had a veterinarian section which checked the food that were shipped in for particularly the frozen things, would they say for consumption?
Right.
The microbiology for the various kind of bacteria and wound infections. There were some of the bigger backs had pathologists on site, but we were the backup support for them.
Okay.
The two forensic morgues, the one at Da Nang and the one at Cholon, which was on the big Air Force base that was in Saigon.
Okay.
Also came under under our control.
Okay.
And parasitology, we did everybody that had parasitology done on them in the outfield hospitals. All those samples were then sent back to us, and they were reviewed.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, while we were there, malaria. South Vietnamese really had pretty much had malaria cured,
mm-hmm.
and the French had done that. And you know, most of the malaria that was coming in was getting carried in from the north, and so it became when the number of cases of malaria went up,
mm-hmm.
and you knew that somebody had come down the Ho Chi Minh Trail and they were in the area somewhere, the number of malaria cases became a military intelligence working factor.
Okay. All right. Just go ahead.
We did specialize. There's two other functions that the laboratory also had a medical equipment repair service, and one of the things that that those guys did was to keep the blood gas machines operable for the various ICUs and the various operating rooms and all of the in all of the evacs throughout the country. And interestingly enough, and this is 1965, and they're not at that instrumentation at that time was really real sensitive, and a lot of times you could fix it, and because just in transporting it back to where it was supposed to be, it'd get jiggled and jarred around enough so that it'd be broken and have to be immediately returned and fixed again.
Okay.
And we did the specialized blood test, chemical blood test, for the rarer things that you can find in both in civilians and in when you've got 300,000 American soldiers there.
Mm-hmm. What about your, more specifically, your role within the 9th Medical Lab?
My role was, I was the, there was a neurosurgery unit. We had two evacs on the, and I can't remember the number of one of them. The 24th was the one who was right next door to us.
Okay.
And there was another one, a surgical evac, and I was the only neuropathology trained person, so I was responsible for their neuropath.
Okay.
The other thing was that I just basically was, as physicians go, the second in command for the unit, and we just divided the surgical path up among the four of us.
Okay.
And we supplied consults to the other evacs in the other units. Now, if there was a specific problem, if there was a, even if it had been defined out of our unit, if there was a real specific problem that occurred, then most of the time a Walter Reed research unit would come over and deal with it. And one of the ones that they had dealt with before we got there, it had been reported to Walter Reed that we had had a lot of helicopter pilots. So they were getting their necks broken in crashes, and they really shouldn't have died.
Mm.
And so they came over and set up a research unit about 1966 and 67, and found that it was the design of the helmet.
Okay.
That when they got jarred real hard, actually the helmet was breaking their neck.
Oh, wow.
So they redesigned that. But that's, they did those specialized, studies, and we just did the normal, what would be considered major hospital laboratory services for any size hospital in the states.
Okay. All right, that brings up a question. I was wanted to ask you if being a pathologist with the 9th Medical Lab, did it differ in many ways than, say, being a pathologist in a hospital back in the States?
It was much different. Actually, in spare time and nights, most of the medical units took care of civilians.
Okay.
And the professionally, this was the best 1 year of my life.
Okay.
From the experience and the learning experience of it. In the States, in the military, the big problem in the military when you got back to the States was that even if you were dealing with somebody that wasn't as competent as you were, and that happened fairly commonly, rank made diagnostic decisions.
I see.
And the other thing was, back in the States, everything was so primitive. Combat zone was real relaxed. Nobody really worried about all this kind of stuff. They didn't worry about whether your shoes were shined and, you know, one of the, it's just the working relationship in a military hospital in the States as opposed to in Vietnam. Now, I've talked to some of the guys that have been in Iraq, and actually, we had it better than they did.
Really?
Now, as far as working relationships and personal equipments and freedoms. But, you know, it's an all-volunteer army now, so and a lot of those guys were trained. You don't put much military in a guy who's had 5 weeks and then is overseas.
Right.
And almost all of us, and practically everybody, almost every pathologist did his hardship year his first year and then came back to the States. Very few people went from had their first year here and then went overseas.
Okay.
And most of the pathologists had more than one run-in on bases with non-medical career officers who just took everything a lot more militarily serious than we did.
Okay. Could you tell me a little bit about some of these conflicts? Could you between the medical officers and the non-medical officers about?
Oh, yeah. My unit in Vietnam was 95% college grads.
Okay.
48% had masters or PhDs.
Okay.
I mean, in the unit section of just about everybody, every unit, and I forgot to mention, we also had a virology unit, had a PhD in it.
Okay.
And so we were a very highly educated group of people, and we did everything together.
Sure.
There was 210 of us. And I hadn't been back to Fort Meade more than 1 month when my commanding officer at the 1st and 2nd Army Medical Lab called me into his office and said that the finance colonel had called him and told him that there was an officer playing volleyball with the enlisted men at lunch, and he wanted it stopped.
Huh.
And, of course, that person was me.
Right.
And if it hadn't been me, it was there was another. And so we sat and thought about it a while, and a number of the guys that we were playing with had been in our units overseas, because when they came back, they had to go to specialized. They were in a specialized laboratory in Asia, so they came back to a specialized laboratory.
Right, right.
And there wasn't but 7 choices. And so we got a fair number of them,
mm-hmm.
and some of them were some of the ones we played volleyball with, and so what one of the other docs and I did was we just went to the back door of the unit, and before we stepped out on the volleyball court, took our shirts off.
Yeah.
That lasted about another month. Then there were people out of uniform. Biggest thing for me and the other non-career scientists with advanced degrees is when we got back was off our units, we were just, there was always something we weren't doing right. Our hats weren't right. We weren't saluting right. We were wearing our hats when we weren't supposed to. We weren't wearing them when we were supposed to. We were carrying objects like a bag of groceries when you shouldn't be. I mean, it's just crazy stuff.
Right.
And now, from the professional side, I got turned into the Inspector General at Fort Meade for 'cause I made a diagnosis of a melanoma on the colonel.
Mm-hmm.
I forgot what kind of colonel he was. And there's no way I could have done that because he had never seen me and I'd never seen him.
Hmm.
And so, you know, I've got the beginnings of, quote, a formal hearing.
Wow.
Coming up. And just because they really didn't understand that I didn't need to see them. All they did was they cut this skin tumor off of the guy and sent it to pathology. The pathology processed it, read the slides, and said this guy's got a really bad disease.
Right.
Had a colonel's wife one Saturday night at 1 a.m. They were coming back from a party somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And stopped at Kimbrough, which is the base hospital.
Okay.
A little class one hospital at right across the parade ground from us. And wanted results of a pap smear Saturday at 1 o'clock. And didn't get it.
Right.
And they had their own pathologist.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, they didn't get it because we hadn't sent it back yet. And I didn't care if it was a colonel's wife, but nobody was getting out of bed at that time to go down and do it.
Sure.
It's just... Well, you know, that's just starting me down a road that part of which I don't even like to think about a whole lot. But
okay.
And those are probably the two biggest or the two examples that it's easiest for me to remember on what the problem was with this one at that point in time.
Okay. Okay. All right. Well, we'll get back to the role of the medical lab itself. Could you tell me? Could you take me through, say, a typical day of your job?
Okay. Typical day for. Is showed up around 'll start with the anatomic path lab first.
Okay.
Start with getting there about 8 o'clock. There'd be four of us. Two of us would have surgical slides.
Mm-hmm.
That we had done the gross and dictated on the day before.
Okay.
That's describe them, and then take the little sections that get turned into the glass slides.
All right.
And then they're processed automatically by machinery overnight, and got to the point where the military histotechs could cut the slides, and then we'd have them the next day. And it averaged about 150. Cases a day, and for us 75 to 80 cases is a full day's work in the States.
Okay.
And but there was four of us, and so that you and we just decided we'd do everything that was came in that day, and then that'd give us the things that were real simple that we could do the answers right off. The next day was fine, and then that gave us 2 days to do research and special stains to get the answers on the other things. And so basically, and then through that day, then we'd check the results and interpret really abnormal results that they came out of any of the other labs, the micro lab, particularly the micro lab and the parasite lab.
Okay.
And virology, those guys knew so much more than we did. We did, and we did not spend a lot of time with the food inspectors on the vet side, out of the veterinarian's office either.
Mm-hmm.
That does bring to mind another thing is when I was there, the clerk typist was a corporal by the name, and well, I won't give you his name, but he was a conscientious objector.
Okay.
And he, not one of the hysterical type people, all he wanted, it didn't bother him as long as he had a non-combatant role. And so he was our clerk typist. Now, and it was the Seventh Day Adventist.
Mm.
And but his wife, so that she could be somewhere close to him, volunteered and was working in a Seventh Day Adventist orphanage. And Native Children's Hospital right outside of Saigon, and one night they got raided by the local VC, who just came in, took all the food and took all the medical supplies. Didn't hurt anybody.
Mm-hmm.
But did scare the willies out of everybody, and people had been hurt in situations like that before, so my conscientious objector just disappeared.
Hmm.
And turns out that he had talked somebody into letting him have some hand grenades and a couple of rifles and a pistol, and he went down and stayed on the roof for 3 days and became a combatant rather than a conscientious objector from that time on. It's just one of those little ironies
that, right, sure,
that could happen. And then now back to our duties.
Okay.
Then if we cut surgicals or did autopsies for somebody who was looking for a post-operative or a medical cause of death that was unrelated to combat, because we did not do any KIA type autopsies.
Okay.
The if they were done, they also were done by the Walter Reed, one of the Walter Reed units.
Okay.
We also were responsible for anything that was a criminal act.
Okay.
A violent criminal act, either against a GI, against another GI, or a GI versus a Vietnamese.
Okay.
And we would review those things. Then the next 3 days, we would spend, and it took almost all of the time, reviewing the slides that we had cut those days, or interpret them, and getting reports typed, and then getting them out to where they were supposed to go.
Mm-hmm.
And essentially, that is about the same as sequence that's done in a private hospital in the States.
Okay.
It's just that these were done in the military and under a different set of circumstances.
Okay.
And so the things that I saw there were always additive to my experiences for later practice when I got back to the States.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And actually, the longer I was out of the service, the more appreciative I was of the fact that I had this transition time right after I left school and my residency program before I went back to practice in the outside world. And it's been long ago. The Berry Plan's been done away with. Everybody's a volunteer now. The military has their own medical school now, and I see four people that have come straight out of practices and into residencies. The military experience really provided a good underpinning for private practice that these guys don't have, because they're out and into basically an unguided situation.
Right. Okay.
And so see, what basically what we did doesn't really seem like what actually you would expect to be part of a wartime experience.
Right. You mentioned these violent criminal act cases. Did you deal with these often?
There were about 700 a year.
Okay.
You know, and not a whole lot gets said about them now, but you know where you get these claims that these bunch of GIs got blown up by a roadside bomb in Iraq, and then they started shooting everybody in the adjacent building.
Right, right.
Kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that happens.
Okay.
And it happened there, and or things similar to that happened there, and one of the forensic side of the unit and the pathologist who dealt with it. Now they were in an entirely different place and had their own own morgues. But what they did was they did the background investigation to establish cause of death, and was this of to establish whether or not this was a criminal act, and then if it was, how was it done, and any other information they might glean from it.
Sure.
It's kind of like watching NCSI as far as if you're familiar with that TV program.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
You know, they've got their own set of investigators, and then they've got their own pathologist who does the autopsies there.
Mm-hmm.
And that's essentially was the forensic morgue's bailiwick and function.
Okay.
Very similar to what you see on TV and in CIS, but not as spectacular and dogmatic.
Right, sure. Okay. Are there any particularly memorable cases that you remember?
Yeah. I did autopsies for the surgical back unit, and it was a black military advisor who was out with the unit of South Vietnamese troops, and they got ambushed and they ran off and left him. And when he got pulled out, he had already had 19 wounds. Plus, he had played havoc with a lot of the ambushers. And that was remembered because, you know, this should never have happened to him. He should never have been abandoned by Vietnam. The other was a young kid, about 5 years old, who had a big tumor at the base of his tongue, and they were operating on him. The evacs, if it was after, quote, routine operating hours, and if there was no emergency surgery, if they wanted to, they could take on treating civilian cases. And one of them was a little kid that had a big tumor growing in the base of his tongue, and we got it right, but it had it actually had brain tissue in it, and we were trying, and you know, what's brain doing at the base of the tongue? And so we sat down and actually had it figured out, because it took us 2 weeks to get it. Wasn't in our books. The internet hadn't been invented. And we could get confirmation from the states that indeed this actually was a teratoma. But we had decided that's what it was for the OR crew. And I remember that because it was just such an unusual occurrence. And the fact that we were all sitting there flying by the seat of our pants, just based on what we knew and remembered from our residency, because our books and our school training, because it wasn't in our book.
Okay.
But everything worked out fine for that.
All right.
And that's fine, too.
Okay. All right. Did the 9th Medical Lab have a Vietnamese counterpart unit? Was there anything similar amongst the South Vietnamese?
No.
Okay.
And there were several reasons for that. They had had a Vietnamese, a medical school at Way, which was right up, about 12 miles inside of the North and South Vietnam divided border,
right,
before the war started. And the few pathologists and the few tissue technicians that they had, I think there were two Vietnamese pathologists left in the country that hadn't been killed. They actually, while I was there, the medical school, what was left of the medical school at Way, got raided, and the docs preferential and the professors preferentially killed.
Wow. Okay.
And so at one time there had been, but with the ongoing war between the French and other, that was a facility that was a specialty that was lost, except for the one little unit that was down in the National Hospital in Saigon.
Okay.
And they couldn't get the information in and out.
All right. What about just general Vietnamese doctors? Did you meet or ever work with any of them?
No.
Okay.
Worked with Thai docs, worked with Korean docs. Just never saw any Vietnamese docs.
Okay. All right. Could you tell me a little bit about, say, okay, we've talked a little bit about, say, your typical day with the 9th Medical Lab and working there. Now, what would you do, say, on a day off when you weren't working? How would you spend your time?
Well, on days off, we went back up to the laboratory and hung around.
Okay.
Because we basically worked 6 days.
Okay.
And had Sunday. And that's why it was just a good break when we take a weekend day and go out to the orphanage.
Right.
Almost all of us, because of the uniqueness of our training. Because see, we were a separate unit.
Mm-hmm.
We weren't either under either one of the two medical divisions. We were an independent unit of 200 people who didn't really belong to anybody in the Army.
Okay.
But we belonged to everybody at the same time.
Okay.
And so, sometimes we'd go over and visit with the Australian docs. They had a unit and a hospital in Benoit.
Okay.
And sometimes we would rarely get off the unit and go into Saigon or Cho Long, just kind of as tourists.
Okay.
But most of the time, you either stayed and worked, or you stayed inside your fence and read, and you just finished up things that piled up that you couldn't get done before.
Mm. Okay.
And, you know, it's sort of a crazy environment. The one thing we did try to do, and a number of the pathologists and a number of the docs got convinced through the personal experience that all of this hype about drug use and stuff in Vietnam that you were seeing in the newspapers and etc. really, if it did occur, and we had no reason to think, really did not occur in every combat unit all the time the way the press made it out to be. And we wanted to, and we had all the materials, we could have done a drug study.
Okay.
And the military, the higher-ups said no, that they didn't want the study even done. And the reason they didn't want it done, we thought, and they hinted at it but never said it. You know, what happens if we were wrong, and the drug problem was really as big as they had thought?
Right.
That the press was making the insinuations that it was.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was a study that never got done.
Okay.
And I know there were a lot of us who still think that there was a lot of people and military officers who got maligned because of supposedly the drug use among the troops. Now, was there drug use among troops, among military personnel? Yeah. But we did not see it in the combat. And the guys that could get killed, most of them stayed far away from it. And the guys who stayed back and worked desk and things like this and were in a support role, no. We all know some of them had used drugs, and it was easy to do. It was incredibly, incredibly cheap, and the drugs that were available over there were much stronger than their stateside counterparts, and. Actually, I was there when they started screening. Everybody had to have a negative drug screen to come out of country.
Okay.
And come home.
Mm-hmm.
And there weren't a whole lot of positives there.
Okay.
Most of the people were clean. But there were some, and there were some misconceptions. There was that if you... did heroin, it was so pure that you could actually inhale it.
Okay.
And didn't leave needle marks, didn't do anything. And the rumor and folklore was that if you snorted it, it wasn't addicting. And those guys ended up going to rehab before they left because it was addicting, and so they'd quit a couple of days before and just run through just terrible withdrawal symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
And again, most of those were not combat people, and
right.
Almost all of that, the drugs, according to the CIS that were over there, and they had a different CID, was what they called themselves then.
Right.
It was coming out of Cholon, which was the Chinese, a big Chinese compound. Well, actually, not compound, it's kind of like. Chinatown in San Francisco.
Right, right, okay.
There was just a big Chinatown outside of Saigon.
Okay.
And almost all of the drugs were coming from there. And it was the doc's belief that these drugs were from... were getting shipped in by the Chinese communists.
Mm-hmm.
But, again, the military was really real sensitive about drugs and didn't even want to think about that. And I think that they did not even pursue the CID suggestion that this was... the Chinese communists were the source of the supports of the heroin coming in. Of course, it was all coming from China.
Right.
But that's just another little odd tidbit.
Okay. All right. If a soldier, say, got caught by the screening before.
You're going to have to speak up louder again.
Okay, sorry. If a soldier, say, got caught by the screening process before going home, what would happen to them?
Oh, they got bad time, and they had to get cleaned up and be attic-free, and then they were sent back to the States. Most of them, I do not know whether they were immediately discharged or they finished out their time. Almost everybody who left there still had time to serve in the military. Most people didn't get discharged from Vietnam straight to civilian life.
Sure.
And I just don't know. I really don't know what happened to them. I know that there were a lot of military non-medical people at who had come back and were at Fort Meade, and there wasn't a real drug problem with them there that I was aware of.
Okay. All right. Were there any cases of, say, deaths from drug overdose or anything that you know of?
In drug death?
Yes, sir.
Would you repeat the question?
Were there any cases of deaths from drug overdoses that you know of?
Well, we got into trouble with that, too.
Okay.
Because we defined alcohol as a drug.
Right.
And, yeah, they were all alcohol-related deaths.
Okay.
And, of course, and the military, by definition, excluded alcohol from being a drug, and actually it stayed that way until about 1974 when some psychiatrist, military psychiatrist, testified before Congress about that alcohol was a drug, and alcohol was a problem in the service.
Okay. All right. Moving on. You mentioned a little earlier that occasionally on your free time, you went to Saigon and Cholon a few times. Could you describe them to me a little bit about your impressions of them?
Well, one of the first impressions that I had was a very interesting one in that when they drove, if the road was four lanes wide,
mm-hmm.
and nobody was coming at you, they would spread out in all four lanes going the other direction.
Okay.
The other thing was that basically it looked an awful lot like most third world cities.
Mm-hmm.
As they look now, except it had a tendency to be cleaner, and there were tons and tons of people.
Mm-hmm.
There was a lot of old ancient sites. There was a lot of things that weren't actually that good for people there too, and I'm just going to stop with that.
Sure. Right there. Okay. All right. I'm jumping around here a little bit. Sorry about that. But let's see. One of the things I wanted to ask you about, you mentioned a while back, a little bit earlier on, with the Knight Medical Lab, you mentioned the blood bank system. And I wanted to ask you a little bit more about that, if you could tell me about that. And where did the majority of the blood come from?
Most all of the blood came from it was collected by the Red Cross and shipped from the States. And a lot of it was blood drives that were done on military bases, and also done in the local in the local Red Cross areas. And we'd get it. It'd take 7 days to get it tested and get it there. And at that time, the stuff that it was collected in was only good for 28 days, licensed for 28 days.
Okay.
And the other thing that would happen sometimes is blood's supposed to be stored in the cold, but not frozen.
Okay.
Or not below freezing. And so, by definition, the definition that's used to describe the temperature is wet ice.
Okay.
Because wet ice is 32 degrees.
All right.
And sometimes it would freeze. The biggest thing is if it indeed expired unused, we would use it transfuse civilians who really needed blood with.
Okay.
And the only side effect that it had is that the preservatives were set up so that 70% of the cells would still be alive.
Okay.
Because red cells actually are still alive in the body. And we never had any problems from it, and for those patients didn't appear to either. And it was the only blood that was available for them. It was either that or none.
Right.
And so it got used rather than poured down the sink.
Okay. All right. What type of a screening process did it go through?
What type of a
screening process did the blood go through?
Screening process, once it got here and got to Vietnam, was it was just matched back up with the paperwork. It was looked at to see if bacteria, you could look at it and tell if bacteria were growing in it. You could look at it to see if it'd been if it had frozen and thawed. And then other than that, it was immediately shipped out to the evac hospitals for use.
Okay. All right. And was this blood primarily, yeah, you said some of the elder blood would use for civilians, but was this blood primarily for U.S. forces only or for all?
I don't know how to answer that.
Okay.
I do know that it was shipped to American evac hospitals to be used.
Mm-hmm.
And that they made their own decisions. We blood tended to be in short supply sometimes, not because of the it didn't get there, that usage would be more, or something unexpected had happened in one of the four military corps, and although there was blood in country, it was at the wrong place.
Okay.
It was down at the Delta when it should have been up in the mountains, or it was up in the mountains and it should have been in the Delta. Everybody made sure there was an adequate supply for American troops.
Mm-hmm.
And there was blood in the bank. You know, it's sort of a one-way system. It gets deposited in the States and gets withdrawn in the combat zone. But
right.
Probably officially, it was for American use, except in extreme emergencies.
Okay.
Because, you know, I hate to be saying something that I'm not really that clear on what military policy is when I try to remember it.
Sure.
This many years later, I do know that we used the, if it outdated, it did go to civilians.
Okay.
Who live because they got it.
Right, sure. Okay, so did the South Vietnamese government or the South Vietnamese military have their own blood bank system?
If they do, I don't know it.
Okay. All right. Okay, another thing I wanted to ask you about, you mentioned that the 9th Medical Lab also had a vet lab. Could you tell me a little bit about it, a little bit more?
Well, the vet lab was responsible for looking at all of the fresh or frozen foods that came into country.
Okay.
To make sure they were fit for human consumption. It's kind of like the blood. It got inspected to make sure it hadn't run into problems along the way.
Right.
And they were also responsible for providing veterinarian support for the military canines.
Okay.
And there are a number of, and rabies was a problem, because nobody over there vaccinated anything before there was a war, much less during it.
Right.
So they basically did food surveillance and prevalence for zoological diseases that could end up in humans.
Okay.
And cared for the military animals.
All right. Okay.
And there was two vets, and that's all the vets there were in the whole country.
Oh, okay. Wow. All right. Let's see. Before moving on to leaving Vietnam, are there any other types of missions or issues with the 9th Medical Lab or with your experience in Vietnam itself that you would like to talk about?
No, I think we've pretty much covered most things.
Okay, all right, very, very good. when did you receive your orders to leave Vietnam?
I received my orders to leave when my then wife ended up with severe psychiatric difficulties. But I remember leaving real well, and I remember and I said at the time it didn't affect me. It affected me some. First of all, as I said when we started this, it looked like that overall the United States was doing, the purpose was the right purpose.
Right.
The way they went about it was a lousy way that you couldn't win. And I felt real bad about that. The thing that I really felt bad about was when we came back in to what's the town that's right across the bay from let's see, there's Los Angeles. We flew into there.
Okay.
And we got off the plane and as we were coming in, there were war protesters just screaming and just, you know, just really hateful.
Right.
Terrible and awful things. And I really felt bad for the 19, 21, 22-year-old guys that, you know, most of them got drafted. Most of them really bore real blunt traumatic problems, and this was just so I really felt bad for them.
Right.
They did not deserve it, and I mean, you know, they got stuff thrown at you. It just like you were a common criminal. And these were guys who had gone over and spent a year and come and that should never have happened.
Yes, sir.
And I said it didn't affect me. It did some, but I thought more so for them because. I went as a military, as a obligated volunteer military doc. I came back as a doc. I hadn't gotten drug out at 19 before I got to school, or
right.
And still. You know, for some of those guys, and I know some of them now. There's a Vietnam support group in Franklin, which is about 20 miles from here.
Okay.
And I've got for my birthday about 4 years ago, my present wife gave me Vietnam veteran license plate.
Mm-hmm.
And with a ninth med lab on it.
Right.
And for the state of North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
And one day I got out of the truck and was just walking across a parking lot. And this guy stopped, walked over and gave me a great big hug and said, where were you?
Mm-hmm.
And he talked about his being down on the Delta and what he did. And
right.
You know, that's just it just brought back a lot of memories.
Sure.
And for a number of these people, they still haven't been able to live the memories down.
Right.
The other thing is that when the embassy fell, and there was a whole lot of young docs, and most obviously come back, and we knew who we were, and in the civilian hospitals we were working in, we knew. Everybody knew who had been where and what their background and experience was. And almost without fail, when the embassy fell, just a real sense of loss and grief and frustration happened to almost every one of those docs. And to a lot of the other... veterans of other kinds, and it became sort of a lot of talk went on about it.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, when that happened, I'd already finished my second year of obligated service, which I finished at Fort Meade.
Okay,
and I got discharged on the 27th or 28th of June, just ahead of a very unusual hurricane that came up the East Coast in 72 and flooded Richmond and I remember I was the second car across one of the bridges in Richmond after they opened it up. I had heard they were closing the road, and I got off the road in Fredericksburg that they were closing I-95 because of the flood. And I got off of in Fredericksburg before the hotels filled up, and then I got up early the next morning and started driving, and I was just coming to this Richmond when they said they opened it up, and I drove by and looked down at the old Richmond Railroad Station, which was underwater up until to its little bell tower on the top. And that was it.
Okay. All right. Now your assignment at Fort Meade, was it exactly basically the same thing you were doing?
I'm sorry, a little louder.
Sorry. Your assignment at Fort Meade for your second year, was it basically the same?
It was exactly the same thing. After I'd been there about 4 months, I ended up as the officer in charge of pathology, and we did the surge path for and the cytology for all the Class 1 hospitals in the 1st and 2nd Army area, and also for the military services that at that time were stationed in Iceland and in Greenland.
Okay.
And my professional functions were exactly the same.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. After arriving back in country and taking on your assignment at Fort Meade, did you find any difficulty in adjusting at all, or was it pretty much the same?
Just professionally, none at all. My biggest adjustment was to the military P pickiness and fine picking of the rules.
Mm-hmm.
That existed on that base that just did not exist in a combat zone.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing was that actually we were supplied better overseas, and it turned out that where there were shortages of equipment and stuff, it was here. And supplies, it was here stateside, because they made sure that what was needed was available in the combat theater.
Yes, sir.
But the rules and regulations for that govern all parts of military life and that they came out right after I got there with this poster of the 17 different ways that a soldier could wear his hair, what his haircut could look like.
Right.
And I told him, you know, that's stupid.
Right.
You've got something that's so so individually interpreted. So how do you look at the picture and apply it to the regulations? If you want to do something that makes everybody know, yeah, you're the boss, and you've got to be shipshape, is make a fast rule on shining shoes. At least you can look at a shoe and tell whether it shined or not.
Right.
And ultimately it turned out that 5 of the 17 acceptable haircuts on that big poster did not meet the Army regulations. And it was stuff like that.
Right, right.
I guess it was the base, the stateside duty and regimentation, that rigid regimentation that became such a problem.
Okay. All right. And when did you you leave the military?
When did I leave the service?
Yes, sir.
June the 26th.
June 26th. Okay. All right. And how did you feel leaving the service?
I felt that I had done the best I could do. I had known for 5 years before I did it, this is something that was expected of me, and I did the best I could, and left feeling as good as I could feel about it.
Right. Right. Okay.
And I tell you right now, I think we'd have fewer problems with a lot of things. This country can't afford a drafted army. And, see, that's one of the reasons that they were thinking about going away from it as I left.
Mm-hmm.
It's because you can't just keep retraining everybody every 2 years.
Right.
But if you had an all-volunteer force, and everybody served in the service, and it was more fair and equitable, and you couldn't manipulate your way out, I don't think you'd have a lot of the political wrangling that you do now. You would have, just think, that would be 18 million Americans between the time I left the service and now that had been in and out of the service.
Mm-hmm.
And there would be more of an understanding. I'm not saying like thrilled by doing, but more of an understanding of what is needed and more of a feeling of being part of the importance of trying to maintain freedom in this country.
Right.
I had somebody call me right after the Iraq war started, the second one, and they said, well, what do you think? And I said, well, I think we'll win the war in 2 months. Actually, it was much quicker than that. I said, but the biggest problem is not winning the war. The biggest problem is going to be winning the peace.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, which we haven't done such a good job of.
Right, right.
And I think the other side of it is that the rest of the United States would have been more tolerant and understood what's going on better had, let's assume that 14 million of those 18 million got married and had families, and that'd be at least one out of four people in the United States that had some kind of understanding about what the relationship of this country, its armed forces, and its way of life, how they're all intermingled.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And what's important. And this is from a guy who resigned his commission when he left in June.
Right.
26, 1972.
Right.
But that's what I think.
Okay. Excuse me. Would you mind, before we close this up, would you mind telling me a little bit about life after the military and your career after the military?
Life after. Found a position working in as a second man in a two-man group in a hospital in North Carolina.
Okay.
Was fortunate and remarried to a wonderful, wonderful woman. And raised the kids and more or less was able to make a fairly good
mm-hmm.
adjustment.
Okay.
Because what I did in the service was just exactly, essentially, the same thing I did when I got out of the service. The experience just helped prepare me for the rest of my life,
mm-hmm.
from a professional point of view.
Right.
It created some problems for the personal, non-working part of the life. That's kind of was not really unique, but I was with a whole bunch of radiologists and internists and surgeons who had also served in the service, and so, you know, without being a formal support group, we were were all the same age. We'd done the same thing in the past. Now we were out doing the same thing again that we'd done in the service. So we're sort of an unofficial support group for each other, I guess, without anybody even thinking about it as being a support group.
Okay.
I hope that answers your question.
Yes, yes, it does. Thank you. Do you ever think about Vietnam anymore?
Do I ever think about it?
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
Okay.
Not in a depressed sort of way, I don't think. As I listen to people tell me that what's happening now is not similar to what happened in Asia, I sometimes have a hard time with that because we dealt with roadside bombs. We dealt with people that just looked like each other. I mean, you know, and for civilians, it's awfully hard to tell if you're a terrorist and you're dressed like everybody else on the street and you look like everybody else on the street. I think that's somewhat similar.
Right. Sure.
Although I've been told that there's no similarity between the two then and now.
Right. Yeah.
But yeah, I think about it.
Okay.
I wish that we had accomplished the goal that we had set out to accomplish.
Right.
Or the defined mission as it was originally defined before it got all caught up in the... You can't bomb Haiphong, you can't go into Laos, you can't do this, you can lose a war fighting with one hand tied behind your back.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Yeah. So, I guess I think about it in a sort of a real mixed, as a real mixed bag, I guess.
Right.
I haven't really thought about the question as you ask it before today, and so I'm sort of realizing as I ramble that, maybe there's more to what I was thinking about than I think there was.
Okay.
If you know what I mean.
Yes, sir. Okay. Well, I know you mentioned earlier that seeing the fall of Saigon and the choppers leaving the embassy and all that had a real effect on you and other doctors who had experienced the same thing as you. But outside of the fall of Saigon, the rest of the war after you got back, did you pay close attention to how the war was progressing?
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, and I was just as frustrated then as I was at times when I was actually in Asia.
Mm-hmm.
It's because, you know, once Saigon fell, then what's really happened is that you can just sit back and look that almost everything that was done turned out to be an exercise in futility.
Right.
Because the ultimate thing you were trying to achieve just wasn't done.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And in a way, it's kind of crazy because this was a war that we made some really funny rules that we had to live by.
Mm-hmm.
And when fighting somebody who hid and worked by ambush and behind trees and out of rice paddies and actually it's kind of like us driving our armies down the road the British marching in red coats all over New England and down into Virginia while the colonists were firing from behind trees. And I mean, you know, we were losing the kind of war that we lost to the Brits lost to us.
Right.
Under the same big principle,
mm-hmm.
if that makes any sense.
Right. Yes, it does. Certainly.
And yeah, when it fell, then everything that had been, it just sort of, that people had struggled and tried to do and sacrificed for, it just sort of negated all of that effort.
Right.
And I'm not the only person who thought that way, because we a lot of us talked about it.
Sure, sure.
Among ourselves.
Mm-hmm. And as the war came to this conclusion and this feeling of futility, the fact that, you know, America had lost its first war, or, well, I don't want to phrase it that way, but the fact that the war had been lost. How did you feel? Were you sad? Were you angry?
I think probably frustration was the bigger of the feelings, because
okay.
It seemed like we could have done what we set out to do,
mm-hmm.
if we had just really approached it as this is something that we've gotten ourselves into, for right or for wrong, and we need to just solve it. And that didn't happen.
Right. Okay. A few last questions for you. How did your experiences in Vietnam affect you the most?
You got a little softer right after. How did my experiences in Vietnam, and I didn't hear the rest
okay.
of it.
Okay. How would you say your experiences in Vietnam affected you the most?
Affected me most?
Yes, sir.
Well, I've said this many times professionally. It's the best thing that could have happened to me.
Right.
From point of view is the impact it had, my being gone when my kids were born, my first wife's mental breakdown and subsequent further deterioration.
Mm-hmm.
That, and I don't know if that would have happened if I was in the States or not, but
right.
It did. There was a time that from a non-professional personal point of view, it was a real tough 2 years.
Mm-hmm. Okay, but as far as your career goes, you said it was probably the best time of your life for that, though, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, look, you can make... You learn how to organize your... a large medical practice to work with a lot of people, how to communicate, how to absorb, and then you've done that for 2 years, and then you walk away and you leave all your mistakes behind you, take all the good things with you, and start all over.
Mm-hmm.
With everything you learn between school and that two years. And yeah, that was it was a tremendous benefit.
Okay.
And I ended up from 86 until 2002 consulting for an Indian health service hospital, mainly an outpatient hospital with 22 beds, and I was just a consultant, but
okay.
It sure, everything I learned about the government and the way the government does things really came in handy.
Mm-hmm.
As I was trying to work through with them.
Okay.
And work through problems. And, you know, the government has a very set way of doing things.
Right. Sure.
But all in all, the professional side was additive and good. And I think I probably said that 6 or 7
sure.
times.
Yes, sir. Sorry to keep asking you about that.
No, but I mean, that's before you asked the question. I mean, I'm just, it was, just, and I know that that's, you know, that's the place you have to go.
Right.
So I think I've covered that about this.
Sure.
Good as I can.
Okay. All right. Well, the last question I wanted to ask you was if there was anything about your experience in Vietnam that you could change. Would you?
Give me the last 3 words you said again.
If
there
was
anything about my experience.
If there was anything about your Vietnam experience that could that you could change, would you?
That I could change?
That you could change, yes, sir.
I still didn't hear you.
I'm sorry. If there's anything about your Vietnam experience that you could change, would you change it?
No, not really, because I would have much preferred to been home when my twin sons were born.
Sure.
But other than that, not really, because the military side of it, I've got no real complaints with.
Okay.
And I wonder if it's 30 years later, you just tend to forget the bad things. But I don't think that's it.
All right. Okay. Well, before we wrap this up, is there anything else you'd like to say?
No. Thank you for being patient with my bad telephone. And I think you've done a good job of really not leading, but just asking questions and letting the answers develop. I hope I've given you something useful that you can use.
Absolutely. Yes, sir. And thank you for agreeing to participate, and thank you for sharing.
You're more than welcome.
All right. I will bring the interview to a close now, and we can talk for another minute or two afterwards.
All right.
Okay.